This is a download from the BBC.
Welcome to The Forum, a world of ideas from the BBC. Hello, I'm Bridget Kendall. What is it that makes your life worthwhile and meaningful, whether you're an atheist or a believer? And can we find it by looking into ourselves, or do we need to be appreciated by others? My guides through the labyrinth of possibilities are philosophers Susan Wolfe and Alain de Botton, and archaeologist-turned-novelist Alexandra Mitchell. Let's start with a question to all three of you, in a few words. When you think of your own life, what's the main thing that gives it meaning and why? Alain.
For me, it's those moments when I understand something and am able to express that understanding in words, when pieces of the jigsaw fall into place.
Okay, what about you, Susan Wolfe?
I don't think there is a single one thing that gives my life meaning, but the primary one would be my family.
Alex, what about you?
Well, for me, I'm just like Susan. I think there are many aspects which give me meaning, but I think that seeking for truth in the past helps me understand much better how I position myself today.
Truly spoken like an archaeologist. Let's explore this a bit more with you, Susan Wolfe. You're a professor of philosophy at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill in the United States. And in your work, you've suggested that one of the key drivers of human life is to live it meaningfully, as you put it. What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, I think of it by contrast with happiness, which I think is an overlapping but distinct dimension of the good life. And really, philosophy is trying to explore, well, what is it that any of us mean when we want meaning? And one way to begin is by asking ourselves who we think live the most meaningful lives, maybe contrasting that with who lives the happiest lives, and then getting a handle on, well, what is it about those lives that makes them meaningful? So when I ask myself whose lives are most meaningful, people that come to mind right away are people like Gandhi or Mother Teresa or Madame Curie, yeah, people.
So not people who are necessarily happy, but people who might be thought of as good.
Well, I don't know whether they're happy. I just don't know that about them. They've done something with their lives. Their lives are worthwhile. You can sort of stand back and say there was some point that we all can appreciate.
The examples you give, like Gandhi and Mother Teresa, sounds as though you're thinking that it's people who help others. Is that where you're going to?
That is probably the easiest case to get agreement on, because almost all of us think it is valuable to help others. But I also mentioned Madame Curie, Einstein, Tolstoy. It could be some, you know, just, you know, pursuing truth seems to me another meaningful activity.
So this is for you like a third category, is it?
Third, right. But not,
which is happiness.
Not happiness, not morality, though, again, overlapping with these things.
So from your own life, give us an example or some examples.
From my personal acquaintance, I was thinking earlier about the contrast by thinking about my two brothers-in-law, one of whom was a very successful businessman, retired early, and now spends his time going from one wonderful vacation to another. I mean, you know, mountain climbing, skiing, travel, and so on. And the other, who is an attorney, I guess you call that a barrister or a solicitor.
Lawyer, yes.
Who works on death penalty appeals. In other words, trying to get people who have been sentenced to death to have reduced sentences. And
that's quite a contrast.
Quite a contrast. One seems the more obviously meaningful, and the other, knowing them and, you know, and how difficult it is, these appeals are very fraught. Happiness isn't the first thing that would come with that. But my more general kind of conceptual idea of what meaning involves is it involves engaging actively with something you love, care about deeply, that is also worthy of love and has a kind of value from outside of our own.
So could it include baking a cake?
Absolutely. You hit one of my passions.
And why is that meaningful?
Well, it may or may not be. It depends on the context and what it means for the baker, maybe who he or she is baking it for. It can be...
Okay, let's define this. If you were baking a cake just for yourself, would that be meaningful?
Personally, no, though I love cake.
That would be self-indulgent.
It's, if you took it as an art, I mean, I actually do, but still I wouldn't do it just for myself. I think excellence, the pursuit of excellence in almost every kind can be meaningful, a pursuit and ideally achievement. So insofar as you're trying to do something other than make a yummy treat for yourself. You know, let's get this puff pastry right, or get, you know, learn how to ice beautifully. It gets more and more meaning the more value it can be seen to have from a perspective that you could be proud of, or that you think.
Now, that's interesting, that word proud, because you've talked about objective value. This, in other words, has to be something which other people value as well as you.
Well, it has to be something that other people ought to value, or that it would be reasonable or appropriate for them to value. Sometimes no one does appreciate something valuable other than oneself. And I think the life is meaningful. It'll be less happy if no one else appreciates you. But so if you take the history of art, there's, you know, all kinds of cases of great artists who were scorned by their contemporaries.
Or wrote for the draw, couldn't publish.
Yes.
Let's see what the others think about this. Alan de Botton, what do you think about Susan's criteria for meaningfulness in life?
Well, I think it's fascinating, but I wonder what you would say about those people who devote a tremendous amount of energy to a project that they think is meaningful and that might seem to be, but then time suggests that it was not at all a good idea. I mean, take someone like Karl Marx, who at one level was doing very meaningful things, and yet it turns out his political propositions were fatally flawed and had a very dangerous effect on many societies' histories. So I wonder what you would say
about... You're talking about communism.
This. Yes, exactly.
A very important question. And often, and Karl Marx is perhaps a good example of this, the terms in which a person thinks of his own life as meaningful don't accurately speak to what is valuable. They'll be somewhat off. But there will also be parts of that life, and again, Marx is a great example, that are tremendously valuable and that are not accidentally related to the project they think they're involved in. On the other hand, there can be great delusions that undermine the project almost entirely, in which case, though they might feel they have meaning and hope they have meaning, history shows us they didn't. it was a disaster.
In that case, I suppose one reason why people rely on happiness as a goal as opposed to meaning is because happiness is more easily verifiable. I mean, it takes place in the individual in real time. And so is a kind of, seems like a surer marker that you're on at least a certain kind of track. Because imagine if one is pursuing a project of meaning that just turns out to be completely wrong. One has nothing left to show for it, whereas your happy brother-in-law who's pursuing satisfaction in the moment, at least he's got the moment of happiness.
It might seem slightly pedestrian, but I think that you place a great importance on the concept of objectivity here as part of this meaningful life. And I was just wondering, who is that? You know, is it most people think that it's a good pursuit, or the right people? You know, there's a concept in archaeology which is an archaeologist's footsteps. It's a beginner's mistake. When you first excavate a site, you don't realize that you're bringing your own layer through your own footsteps
within.
So, you know, what is your baggage? You know, what makes it objective?
Well, we'll never know. I think it's a never-ending project. What's truly valuable is a never-ending project. But we do our best, and there's no reason to think that we're utterly deluded that helping people is a meaningful project or that...
Well, that means that you also can't be absolutely sure what is meaningless, can you?
That's right.
I mean, I think you've written that you think doing puzzles like Sudoku is a bit of a pointless project. But some people, it might be a delightful period of meaninglessness in a very busy life.
Oh, and
isn't it?
Well, I'm all for delightful periods of meaninglessness. And all of my examples of meaningless activity are ones that I myself engage in and am always at risk of spending too much time engaging in. I like television also.
Television, meaningless.
Depends on the television and who you're watching.
Alex?
I'm sure that Susan, even in a time of, I would call it release, you know, you're not actually thinking consciously. I'm sure that someone like you would be constantly thinking, but in a more subconscious way. You know, the way we suddenly write a paper in one go, because we've actually been thinking about it for a while you call it Sudokus or, I don't know, playing squash, doing something entirely different.
Well, that would be a nice interpretation on the ways I waste my time.
I just want to pursue this idea of meaninglessness, because Alan de Botton, in your latest book, Religion for Atheists, this is something which you look at a bit. You're quite interested in this idea that in modern society, we humans tend to overplay our own significance in the world. And one of the things you argue is, well, perhaps we ought to spend more time contemplating the vastness of the universe and the meaninglessness of our existence in comparison, which is a paradox, isn't it, that you find meaning through contemplating your meaninglessness?
Well, I think there is a way in which we can sometimes be hampered, paralysed, panicked by how meaningful the stuff that we're doing is. I mean, it's difficult because as a human being, you have to take yourself quite seriously in order to get out of bed every morning. Otherwise, what's the point? But then in the middle of the day, you can be felled by, as it were, a kind of such a sense that what you're doing is so important that you lose sight of what really matters. And so I think particularly if you're living a busy, urban, modern life, you will find moments when you've just exaggerated the meaningfulness of your own existence, your own pursuit, your own project. And it's at that moment that it might be quite helpful to look at the stars, to spend time with an animal, to hang out with a child, because children and animals have very different senses of what's meaningful, and they can usefully disrupt adult interpretations of meaning, or go for a walk in the country. So nature is a tremendous release from kind of human-centered meaning.
But you particularly pursue the idea that we could take a few pages out of the notebook of religion and look at religious rituals as a way of helping non-believers understand man's lowly insignificance. Not that you need to start believing in a god or a higher being, but that just that religion's better at this than atheism.
Yes, I mean, strikingly, one of the things that all religions do is make us feel small in the context of a kind of larger cosmos or in relation to a god. And this can seem to modern human beings as a rather humiliating manoeuvre. You know, why? Someone's made me feel small. And of course, feeling small is often quite humiliating. If you were to walk into a posh hotel and be humiliated by, you know, the guy at the door, you might say, you know, I hate being made to feel small. You know, who do they think they are? But there's a difference between being made to feel small by another human and being made to feel small by something that is larger than human beings. And traditionally, in religions, that has been God. Now, once you lose a religious perspective, where's that very useful decentering, miniaturizing push going to come from? And I think it's something that kind of modern secular people struggle with. And I think that's why things like observing the stars or getting out into nature has come to seem so important to people. It's more than just a pastime. It's more than just something you do for your health. It's kind of psychologically really important. And it's a replacement for something that religions naturally do, which is once a week or more to put us in an environment where we feel tiny in relation to massive, mighty, rather noble forces, which religions generally call God.
Does that fit into your framework, do you think, Susan? Contemplating our own insignificance?
Yes, actually, I'm all for it. Though I would make a distinction between our insignificance or our smallness, or as I sometimes call it, our speckness. I mean, the fact that we're just tiny specks in a vast universe, and being utterly meaningless. So I guess my motto with respect to this issue is go for quality, not quantity. That is, don't try to be important. Don't try to make a big splash, but make it a good splash. And the meaning to me comes from the difference between living one's life well and badly rather than being important or unimportant.
And what about adapting religious rituals? What do you think, Alex, about that?
I'd like to say that I think our sense of fate or the absence of a sense of fate often gives meaning to our lives. It steers us in one way or another. See, the mere idea that everything is already written, whether it is from the point of view of religion or genetics, for instance, is a completely different viewpoint from that of someone who would believe that you can be and do whatever you want against all odds, regardless of your habits, your path, your upbringing, and all these almost invisible ways in which you're the sum of previous generations. So for me, to sum up, your life will be entirely different whether you do or you don't believe in free will, something which runs through my novel because I became really obsessed with this idea of free will.
Does contemplating man's insignificant or speckness, as Susan put it, then do you think that is a contemplation of lack of free will,
well,
necessarily?
It always comes back to context. I think you need to compare yourself to other things. So I think Alan is completely right. My first ever religious experience, or maybe only, a religious experience that was very young. And I had exactly that image. I thought of myself laying on my bed and gradually looking higher and higher through the ceiling, through the house, from the point of view of the sky looking down on the house, and then suddenly was stuck in the universe. I think I was 10, and I freaked out.
You remind me how children, when they address letters, they very often say, Bridget Kendall, BBC, in London, in the UK, in the world,
exactly.
In the universe, in the cosmos. It's that Alan's talking about, isn't it?
That's terrible fear,
Yeah. But, actually, in your book, Alan, you kind of take it a step beyond that and say, well, literally these religious artifacts and rituals we should adapt for our modern life. So, for example, you have one idea that instead of soaring cathedrals, we should have towering temples to perspective, with the span of humankind's existence on world just being a tiny band 1 millimetre thick, so you can contemplate how short a time we were on earth. But that this idea of taking rituals without their core faith that's at the centre of them, it's just a little bit spooky, isn't it? It's a bit like George Orwell's dystopias.
Well, my starting point is that for thousands of years, religions have been very intelligent about channeling a whole range of human needs. The need for community, the need for consolation, the need for meaning, the need to be educated, the need for morality. Religions have invented all kinds of structures to make these things go well. And so there are such things as choirs, churches, cathedrals, mosques. There are rituals like the Jewish Day of Atonement or the burial services of all religions. These are often very beautiful, very intelligent manoeuvres that religions have learnt how to perform. And I suppose my starting point is, once you do away with a belief in the supernatural, what happens to all those needs? Do they miraculously disappear? Are we then just happy with, making a living and then dying and that's it? No, we're not. We're left with all sorts of needs which are unattended by a lot of modern society. And so what I try and do in the book is sketch various ways in which certain of the needs that religions have been very good at handling could be addressed in new and creative ways by modern society. So I look, for example, at things like community. Religions are very good at community. Why? Not because they do anything that miraculous or indeed that supernatural. They're just very good at gathering people on a regular basis in rather uplifting and beautiful circumstances. We don't really think about that. We haven't, the modern mind hasn't taken that project very seriously. Or take religious architecture. I love architecture, and I'm always struck by how secular people say things like, I hate all religion, but I do love the buildings. And my response is to say, well, can't we learn from that a bit? I mean, is it really true that the things we admire in religious buildings should simply have come to an end once we decide that, Jesus wasn't the Son of God? Or isn't there, can't we learn lessons, useful lessons, from the best bits? And of course, religious people will go, you can't do that without God. You can't sort of pick and mix from the best moments of religion. But I think that religion is a cultural product, not a divine product. And therefore, one can pick and mix as much as one does from other works of culture, just as one creates playlists of songs, picks among ideas in philosophy, and finds interesting moments in literature. We can do the same with religion.
What do you think, Alex?
I think I'll be a bit more circumspect with regards to religious belief, just from the point of view of having seen and studied so many different religions, either in the same spot or in different parts of the world, over long periods of time. What would you take out? What would you use from burials or, more importantly, mourning procedures in religions?
Well, yeah. I think one thing that I would take is to pay a lot of attention to the aesthetic side. And in the modern world, we've very much separated content from the delivery of content. So we'll say, is it a good idea, rather than is it nicely expressed? Is it the truth, or is it just beautiful? And most religions come from a deeper, older tradition which unites truth and beauty.
But then
therefore, most services are both a mixture of some very consoling words said very beautifully. And anyone who's ever been to a humanist service will probably quite like the sentiments that are expressed, but probably recoil from the dress of the person who delivered them, the musical accompaniment, the architectural accompaniment.
No, but
and
hang on.
My question is more practical. In the Jewish tradition, there's a week called the Shiva, which is fascinating from a psychological point of view, where The children of the deceased, not the husband or wife of the deceased, but only the children are stuck in a room and they have to stay there and live in that room for an entire week. And you realize that it's a sort of a shock therapy whereby these people have to relive. They might be husbands and wives by that time. They might be 40, 50 years old, but they suddenly are children for a week because all these old habits, everything has to go back to their primal state, their childhood.
You know. But the key question, though, is do you have to believe, isn't it? I mean, can you take this packaging, this beautiful packaging, and apply it to modern life without the faith
great
that goes with it?
Well, I think a religious person would say, and I completely understand why, they would say, no, you can't. You know, you can't just, you know, love the music of Bach but not believe in the resurrection. You can't just admire Chartres Cathedral but have nothing to do with the Gospels. But I think, as an atheist, the sort of troubling thing is, of course you can. Of course you can get a lot out of Bach believe in it.
What do you think, Susan Wolfe?
Well, I think we already do a lot of that, and that is, there are rituals of all kinds, national holidays, personal family traditions that may or may not have a religious aspect to it.
Alan's suggesting we should have secular saints and psychotherapeutic travel agencies who send us off on pilgrimages instead of package holidays.
That's great.
Well, what would your brother-in-law think?
I have some skepticism about saints in general, secular or otherwise, but heroes.
Exactly. I'm not saying saints in a supernatural way. I'm precisely talking about the project of admiration, which is under great suspicion in the modern world, that to admire, particularly in Europe, not so much in America, but in Europe, the idea of admiring is seen as a kind of threat to one's own independence and autonomy, and it could mean that one's being hoodwinked by someone who is secretly quite corrupt. So there's lots of unnecessary suspicion around the project of admiration, and that's what I'm simply drawing attention to, that admiring should be part of a good life.
But doesn't that take us back to the problem we were discussing with Susan? Who decides? Who decides on the objective value?
Well, this is
you don't have a divine authority.
So this is a terrific anxiety of modern people, particularly the media. Who decides? And that question is often asked with the memory of the Nazis in the background, the fear of some spectre who's going to decide for us. We live in democracies where, in market democracies, where the only way in which anyone
countries.
Is going to decide is going to be through popular opinion, really. And so no one's going to decide for us. Ideas rise to the top because, people who believe in them are artful proponents. We're not talking about an authoritarian system of decide. No one's going to decide for you. But people like Susan and I and Alexandra are just people who are putting ideas out there and hoping that others will grab them.
Okay, well, let's see if your idea gets grabbed by our audience. Do let us know what you think. This is The Forum from the BBC. Today, searching for meaning in life and in history. But first, our 60-second idea to change the world. And this week it's from writer and philosopher Alain de Botton. And Alan, you've been here before, you know the score. You've just got 60 seconds to make your case to me, Bridget Kendall, and my other two guests, American professor of philosophy, Susan Wolfe, and archaeologist-turned-novelist, Alexandra Mitchell. So if you're ready, you can start now.
Well, what I'd like to do is to reform education. I want to change how schools and universities teach people and what they teach in particular. I think that we're very good nowadays at teaching practical subjects like accountancy and microbiology. What we're still very bad at doing is instructing young people systematically in many of the challenges of daily life, how to have relationships, how to bring up children, how to manage one's anxieties and ambitions, how to face mortality. These things are not systematically addressed in the education system. So in my ideal world, I'd have regular classes in which the works of culture of humanity, literature, plays, works of art, are used as conduits to contemplating some of the large and important questions. And we'd stop treating self-help, as I might call it, as something that is merely for idiots, and see it as something that all of us have to wrestle with in order to have any chance of leading a good life. So that's my plan for a new kind of education system.
Thank you, Alan. I suppose in some ways it's kind of obvious, isn't it, in that there's lots of great literature and children's literature, which often has a moral tale woven into its plot. Harry Potter, the power of parental love to vanquish evil, for example, or Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice.
Well, yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned Jane Austen, because, of course, she was very interested in literature having a moral force. And basically, what does that mean? That means books making us good. And that sounds so weird nowadays. I mean, if you went to any university and said, you know, you want to study literature because, you know, you want to be good, people would look at you as though you were insane. Any practical project which we're expected to have in relation to culture is deeply suspicious in contemporary academia. And this is really unfortunate, because it means that one of the great resources by which people do grow wise is being systematically denied to students generation after generation.
Literature making us good. Alexandra.
I think that your idea is wonderful, but it reduces great works of art, which actually could bring a lot of wisdom through their diversity, it reduces it to one idea. I mean, if you take Mrs. Bovary, is it
Madame Bovary?
Madame
by Flaubert.
By Flaubert. Do you take it as a study of, you know, romanticism or young girls' dreams and delusions, or about failed marriages, or how to organize a ballet in suburban France, or a perfect example of écriture réaliste? Well, I mean, it could be loads of different themes.
Absolutely. But I think the fear of academia is often so great in relation to reduction that academics will say, well, we can't possibly say, you know, Madame Bovary should be used for this, because what about, you know, the other things it might be used for? To which my answer is, well, let's use it at least for something. If we were to, you know, have a class in how to resist illusion in which Madame Bovary's had a starring role, fine, great. At least it's being used for some practical end.
A self-avowed utilitarian approach to
culture.
Totally
utilitarian.
Okay, Susan Wolfe, what do you think?
I share Alex's ambivalence. I mean, I think the idea for some courses or some strands of courses emphasizing the value literature and philosophy has for how to live is terrific. On the other hand, it's a bit in tension with your own idea that we should stop thinking of ourselves as the center of everything and see, you know, the point of a work of literature or a philosophy as how is it going to help me live my life? And so I think there's also a great value in just teaching a work, encouraging people to see it for its own sake, to be open to whatever it has to offer.
I think what you're saying is, you know, there are dangers of egocentricity, but in my ideal education system, there would be classes in the dangers of egocentricity, which might involve studying a text merely for its own sake. So with intent. It's about making explicit many of the things that academics only reveal at moments when they're putting together a funding application or talking in public forums about the value of what they're up to.
I'm completely skeptical. You know, if I went back to university and thought that all my classes were in the end about self-improvement, I would be intensely irritated.
But Bridget, is that because, and I think it might be because you're so perfect, that you don't need to be self-improved, but for the rest of us, like me, deeply flawed individual, I'm constantly looking to improve myself.
It's the propaganda purpose of it that would annoy me.
What's wrong with propaganda?
Fascistic. I mean, it's too hands-on, and this is coming from an archaeologist. I mean, I think you need to take a step back and let students of all sorts find beauty or interest or practical values to various books in their own ways.
But I think, again, modern academia is a little bit too squeamish about this. There's a sort of feeling among right-thinking people that we shouldn't too forcibly direct anyone towards any idea, because as Bridget said, it could be propaganda and that would be a terrible thing. I think we need to get real here. We live in a world where we are daily bombarded by messages by people who have no qualms whatsoever about propaganda. We live surrounded by advertising, by political messages and other things. And meanwhile, all the nice people have said things like, oh, well, no, we mustn't influence anyone too much.
So all the great guns
of culture are being silenced, that the voices of those very powerful novelists and artists are being treated, you know, are being muffled behind academic politeness, when in fact they are the only resource with which we can combat the truly pernicious propaganda. So, Bridget, to your argument that this might be propaganda, the solution to propaganda is not an absence of propaganda, it's good propaganda.
Oh, well, I come back to the question I raised before. Who decides? But it's a great idea, a great discussion. And if you're listening and have your own thoughts to add, do get in touch via Facebook, Twitter or email, all details on our website. Now, we've been talking in various ways about meaning in life, but what about meaning in history? And Alexandra Mitchell, as you said, you are an archaeologist and a fiction writer. And in your archaeological work, you're often faced with the task of trying to understand what a particular object meant to those people who used it centuries or even millennia ago. Mm. And your argument, your fundamental argument, is that it's all down to context, right?
Yes. I mean, when you find something on an archaeological site, it will most likely be within a certain context. And if you compare this with an object in a museum, which is often devoid of any context, you see, an object can strike you as beautiful, but more often than not, it won't have any other meaning than aesthetical. It would have lost what made it meaningful because you can't see in what way it was used or how it was intended to be used. So, for example, if you take something more recent, 13th century or, 12th century Byzantine ivory plaque, these beautiful objects. In museums, they're often displayed in a brilliant light, which allows us to appreciate all the magnificent details of the carvings. But that's not how they were intended to be seen. They were intended to be seen and venerated in churches, which were, by the flickering light of oscillating oil lamps or candles. And so the context and therefore the visual feeling one gets is completely different, and so is the meaning of the plaque.
It's an interesting argument. I was just thinking about the Sistine Chapel, that maybe they shouldn't have cleaned it and brought all the vibrant colours back, but left it as it was in smoky candle oil.
I would call that a sort of romantic view of ruins. I think that real poetry doesn't come from looking at ruins, but from recreating what is past. I find that actually the word poesis in Greek means to produce, and this production of meaning I find more beautiful in a way, more poetic.
Okay, well, give us an example from antiquity of something, some object in a museum which had a completely different meaning once you found out more about its context, once you took your trowel out, as it were.
I worked on various subjects, one of which is a thousand of these small clay figurines, which we call grotesques. And they sometimes present actual pathologies, medical pathologies, and we were really trying to figure out what they meant.
Little figures that might have bulging eyes or a hunchback.
Diseases, Pott's disease. And there were a number of them which were very odd, which showed a naked man holding his hands to his throat in a gesture of suffocation. And we couldn't make heads or tails of it until, some thought it could have been an image of tuberculosis or because of the ingestion of a foreign object that blocked the breathing of the person. And it's only until someone discovered a mosaic floor in the island of Kefalonia in a Roman villa, which showed a young man choking himself in the same way as the figurines and attacked by a leopard. And the figure was identified in the inscription below as a personification of envy. So clearly the figure is suffocating with jealousy. And that was the key image that unlocked the meaning of these many random figurines, which we find in many museums. And so the clay figurines must be now interpreted as personifications of the evil eye. And some of them even have a little hole at the back of the figurine to basically suspend them. It's a suspending hole. So the notion of the evil eye in antiquity was really important, and it's based on envy. And envy is to covet by looking. So these figurines probably hung near houses, near the threshold, of the house, or as an apotropaic symbol, something against the evil eye. So from
that is these amazing that just from one mosaic, the meaning could be added to quite so many hundreds and thousands, you say, of figurines.
Well, very often it's through comparing, so you could call it extreme comparison, through comparing hundreds or thousands of objects that you actually can find a meaning.
But what about the bigger point here, though? The idea that you can't understand meaning without context here in a historical environment. Alain de Botton, what do you think?
Well, look, I think it's obviously extremely valuable, the work that archaeologists do in restoring appropriate meaning to objects. But I think for the rest of us who are not professionals, but yet who have a bit of education, there can sometimes be a terrible fear that unless we know a lot, we're not going to be able to understand anything. That the context is going to be so complicated that unless we have the whole story, we just don't dare to really even think about what we're seeing. So sometimes we walk through a museum just reaching out for the captions to help us, but we don't really want to look at the object and guess that we might have a shot at appreciating, understanding an object. So it can really sort of hamper spontaneity. So on the one hand, you've got the sort of romantic view that anyone's guess is as good as anyone else's, and, you know, you can look at an old Roman bit of whatever and, you know, have a go, which is obviously wrong and in a way arrogant. But I think the opposite is a kind of tremendously cautious, hampered approach, which just means that one just thinks, you know, until the archaeologists gets to me, I'm not going to say anything. I'm not even going to look properly.
Oh, no.
And I think that's also a pity.
Oh.
So I think there's, you know, there's a danger.
Alain, you have the most extraordinary view of academia. It's extraordinary. I can't believe it. You know, it's all about observation. Archaeology is about looking. The first thing you do is you learn how to open your eyes and look at objects and describe them. You either look or you redraw them. These are the only two ways to really understand an object. Context, everything comes with, you know, acquisition of knowledge, but common sense is really important. And I don't think most people are afraid of giving their opinion in a museum. I'm afraid more often than not that museums don't give enough information to visitors and make it rather a sad visit.
I must say, certainly as a journalist, when I think about pieces of information, the more context you have, the more you know, the more meaning it has. It's really important as a tool for journalists. But I wondered, Susan Wolfe, as you're a philosopher, do you think you can extrapolate from this that you can't understand meaning without context?
Well, though I accept Alain's point that we shouldn't be intimidated to try to understand what we can from wherever we are, I also think, absolutely, context is crucial to really understanding something, to getting its meaning. Knowing the context, the use, the significance of an object in its original and especially intended place is very important. But I also think one can go too far to think that that's all there is. So to take actually the case of a possible evil eye, not the grotesques perhaps, but other kinds of sculptures that had an intended use that we now find beautiful, even though beauty wasn't the salient purpose of these things, they might actually be beautiful, and that we, you know, we get new layers of meaning by recognizing things that...
I agree absolutely.
That's right. I mean, in a way, you can get the meaning wrong and benefit from it. If you think of the way in which the history of Greece and Rome was totally misinterpreted by many, many people in the 18th and 19th centuries in Europe, they sort of made up what the Greeks and the Romans were actually like. Now, in a sense, that tells us an awful... It was very useful to them that they were able to do that. It wasn't a very good way to understand the cultures of Greece and Rome, but it was very helpful for them. And, you know, so I think there can be a value in getting meaning wrong or readapting meaning.
It is interesting, this, isn't it? Because we began by talking about, you know, what gives meaning to your life today and talked about, you know, the importance of other people. And now we're talking about the importance of meaning as a layered thing through the ages. So,
I mean, you know, we very often, I you know, you come across these ideas of in Europe, of, you know, Europe as a beacon of light and the East as this sort of totalitarian and non-democratic way. And people seem to think that it's something very new. And it's completely...
Well, that's very fast being outdated, I think,
know,
isn't
and
it?
It's wrong, but it's completely entrenched in very old ideas, which are Greek. At a time when Greece was trying to express itself or become a nation, not in a 19th century sort of way, but to form itself, and it had to do it in opposition to the great empire to the east, which was Persia. So obviously
does that mean then that the lesson we have to draw from this is that to improve meaning in our life, we not only have to understand and add it, but perhaps we need to subtract some old meanings?
Yes.
Last word to you, Alain.
Well, I think, you know, what we've been doing is very much what I think academics should be doing more of, which is we're looking at the very practical, very useful dimensions of philosophy and archaeology, and we're looking at the way in which, you know, the way we live now can be illuminated and given meaning by things from the past. And so we're on the right track, for my educational program. So I'm happy.
I don't think we're all signing up to your utilitarian way of looking at the world.
I'm just trying to rope you in there. You know you agree with me.
Thanks to all three of you, Alain de Botton, Susan Wolfe, and Alexandra Mitchell. And next week, another subject that probes into the depths of who we are, the challenge of ageing. Guest presenter Baroness Helena Kennedy will be in the chair, with a live audience at the London School of Economics, as well as Swedish champion of visual statistics, Hans Rosling, the founder of Oxford's Institute of Ageing, Sarah Harper, and one of Britain's sprightliest nonagenarians, crime writer P.D. James. But for now, from me, Bridget Kendall, and all of us here at the Forum, have a good week. And for our bird song this week, it's from the woodlands of the Blue Ridge Mountains of Susan Wolfe's home state, North Carolina.
If you've enjoyed this BBC podcast, why not try others, such as In Our Time, where Melvyn Bragg discusses the history of ideas. To find out more, visit bbc.com/podcast.